Okay, my name is Peter Maiden, and I'm a reporter with IndieBay.org, which is a website of the Indie Media Network in San Francisco. And I got interested in the issue of the San Jose police and how they deal with mentally ill people when one day at my day job I was reading the paper. I work in a warehouse, and I saw that a man named Zain Bolshik had just been shot by the police and that he was mentally ill. And I just said to some of my coworkers, I can't believe the San Jose police had killed another mentally ill person, because this was the third time in 16 months that they had shot somebody to death who was unarmed because of a conflict between a police officer and a mentally ill person. So I went to the San Jose Mercury website and downloaded all their articles about police-involved shootings of mentally ill people, and I learned some very interesting stories, and I'll tell you the stories of the three people that this happened to recently. The most famous case was a killing on July 13, 2003, of Big Cow T. Tran, who was a Vietnamese woman who lived in San Jose. She had a child unattended, according to a neighbor who called the police, and when the police came, Officer Chad Mitchell came into the apartment, and within a few moments, Cao Tran was shot to death. She had a vegetable peeler in her hand, which the police officer said looked to him like a cleaver that she would possibly use to throw at him, and apparently she was yelling at him in Vietnamese. She didn't have much English. This electrified the Vietnamese community. We couldn't believe that a big, strapping, big police officer would need to shoot a woman who was 4'9" and 98 pounds in her kitchen over basically nothing. The police tried several methods of putting spin on this. They actually displayed the vegetable peeler to the press and said, "You see, it looks like a cleaver." And it didn't look like a cleaver at all to anybody who saw it in the newspaper. I don't understand why they did that. They also went on Vietnamese radio and tried to calm down the community. I guess there's a couple of Vietnamese-speaking officers, and they tried to get some points. But the biggest thing that worked the best for them was when they found out that Cao Tran had been given risperidol, which is an antipsychotic. She had some in her bathroom, and she had not taken any. There wasn't any in her system. So they traced that back and found out that she was had seen psychiatrists. She had a couple of so-called breakdowns, and that she was considered psychiatrically ill. When there was a grand jury hearing, every aspect of her mental illness was presented to the grand jury in such a way that the stigma around it, people thinking that because she was mentally ill, why didn't she have attacked a police officer? And it brought into question everything about her in such a way that the revelation assisted the police department in avoiding any charges against the officer who was just put back in the force. The next killing was Johnny the Cow. That was August 12, 2004. He was the son of a deputy sheriff, and he had had mental health problems. He was dual diagnosed. He had drug addiction problems. And he was suspected of trying to lift a CD player from a radio shack, and the clerks called police, and they came and they confronted him. He was uncooperative and they tasered him. He ran out of the radio shack and down into an alley, and they came after him. And when he saw them confront him, he drew a pocket knife, probably trying to protect himself against a second shock, because the taser shock is very painful. That didn't work. They shot him dead. It turned out in the autopsy that he was clean of drugs. He was just very upset with his condition, and he had something I learned from Andrew was that he had been to Valley Medical Center several times in the previous couple of weeks trying to be let in because he thought he needed help, and they turned him away each time. The third killing was on September 20th, 26th of last year, and that was Zain Gloshek, who was a Bosnian immigrant, and he was at a Starbucks, and he was smoking in an area that was considered non-smoking. There was an officer there, I believe his name was Donald Guess, and he confronted Gloshek, who defended his right, I suppose, to smoke, and they got into a bit of an altercation, and Gloshek's friends wanted to step in and were asking the officer if they could work this out, and he made them all move away, pushed them all away. He tasered Gloshek, and that made Gloshek so mad. I mean, the tasers are supposed to incapacitate a person, but in his case, it just made him very angry. And he picked up a chair and threw it, or attempted to throw it, at the officer, who then shot him dead. A friend of his was quoted in the Mercury, one of the other Bosnians that would hang out there. He said, "We would hang around the Starbucks for years," I'm quoting, "and we would feel sorry for him because he was mentally ill. He was always laughing and joking. He never fought with anybody. He was a quiet guy smoking his cigarettes. He never stood a chance up against this cop." And that was the third killing that got me motivated to do this story. I started going to meetings of the Coalition for Justice and Accountability, which was a group that was started after the Caltrain case took place. I met several very helpful and interesting people there. It's led by Richard Conda. He facilitates the meetings and organizes them. And he told me in an interview that if a person has certain mental health issues, they may not react the way a police officer either wants them to react or expects them to react. Maybe they just can't react that way. And that got me thinking that if there was greater training, perhaps they would learn how to talk people down instead of using any of their arsenal of so-called non-lethal weapons and lethal weapons. The Coalition for Justice and Accountability has recently been organizing quite a bit around the issue of tasers. A San Jose Police Department study that a man named Junya showed me said that between May and October of last year, 79% of taser deployments involved people who were on drugs or alcohol, 64 different cases, or mentally ill, 23 different cases, or both. It seems like disproportionately mentally ill people are on the receiving end of tasering, and they're also concerned that the taser does not calm the situation down, but escalates the situation. And in fact, for Gloshek and DeKalb, the taser led to their being killed, and was therefore lethal in both of their cases. In the coalition, I met Jose Rangel, and I'll leave to Andrew to talk about his issues, except for one thing I wanted to say, which was that he made an issue with me around 5150s, which are the kind of detention that you get for being a threat to yourself or others. It's a forced mental health hold, and when you get 5150, they take you in Santa Clara County to Valley Medical Center for 3 days, and you're locked in, and then they'll let you go unless they have a reason to keep you in the hospital. I called around to find out how many of these there were in a given period. I went through some very uncooperative secretaries. I finally found a therapist at the medical center who was an outpatient, didn't have anything to do with the holes, but he knew a nurse who would do what I needed to know. And I called her, and she said, "Yes, I know, but I can't tell you." So I called the press officer of the hospital and asked her to please speak to the nurse, and that the press officer could relay to me the information that I wanted to get. And that worked out, and I found out that there are 451 50 holds a month at Valley Medical Center in San Jose, which is an astounding 4,800 a year. And that's a lot of people. It's not really an arrest. You don't get an arrest record, but it's a lot of people who are in extreme crisis, according to the rule of how they work it, and are being detained against their will. In researching the Caltrans case, I came across...
Can I just ask three questions?
Sure.
Out of the 5150s, were you able to find out how many were then held over for, say, like the 14-day?
No.
Not able to get further?
No, I didn't find that out. That's an interesting question.
You know, I just wanted to say, I've been 5150 in Berkeley and sent to hearing. And first they say they're giving you a 72-day hold, and then without letting me appear in court, it went for about 2 weeks, and then they kept me for a whole month for no good reason, and they never let me appear in court to have a public defender defend me or to defend myself.
Thank you.
Is it possible they have the right to extend the 72 hours to 14 days? On their own psychiatric feedback and then to 30 days.
They write a bunch of lies.
Why no? And I'm not saying it's true, but I'm just saying, do they have that right then?
Yes, we can talk about that. I know it's yes and no. There has to be a theoretical hearing, there is a hearing. But I think and I'll be happy to fill people in on that. But I think that we might want to, I don't know if we want to go on with the
session. Yeah, why not go with the flow and then have questions afterwards. We have plenty of time to cover questions.
Okay.
In researching the Caltrans case, I came across the crisis intervention team, which is the only thing the San Jose Police Department are doing about improving how to deal with mentally ill people. And I reached the head of it, a guy named Officer Dr. Greg Sancier. And Officer Sancier agreed to meet with me at a Starbucks on his day off, which was nice, and he came out of uniform. And we talked about 45 minutes. I tried to be tough on him. I found he wouldn't talk about any cases that were up for civil litigation, which means all of the killings of mentally ill people that I was dealing with were up around for civil litigation. So he wouldn't comment on any of those things. But he did tell me some interesting stuff. They have a 40-hour program in the Academy of Immersion and Mental Health Information. The training is given to 46 officers a year. Only 300 out of the 1,450 officers on the force have been trained. And at that rate, I did the math, it came out that it would take 25 years to train the whole department. So people who do have the training wear a little pin that says CIT, and they get called in when there's a case that requires their expertise. I asked him, without referring to specific cases, if he could tell me how police feel about what happens when they kill a mentally ill person. And he said, and I quote, "There is complete regret on behalf of the officers. Officers can live with that for the rest of their lives in terms of post-traumatic stress. It's the most tragic of situations when someone with a mental illness is shot and killed. Despite the fact that the officer is still living, his life is never the same after that." So as you might imagine, it's difficult for the police, who are human beings, to deal with their stress, obviously, and to deal with what they've done when they do something like that. He offered to me that I could ride along with the police for a day. I was a CIT-trained officer, and I agreed to do that. we arrested some guy and went around doing stuff for several hours, and then he got called to handle a case at a high school where a young woman had filed an assault charge, or was wanted to file a charge of sexual assault. She was 15. And she, they found out in a preliminary interview, was on psychiatric medication. So he called back to the station and asked if I could be in on this, and they said no, it was too sensitive, so he had me go with another cop. But on the way out, I overheard our deputy sheriff say that, he said, and I quote, "We run into everyone in this county that's on medication at one time or another." So I wrote that down. I was wondering about that. I went with another cop. It turned out to be somebody I had met because he lived in a condominium that I live in now. And I noticed something interesting about him. He was kind of a fun-loving guy, but his way of having fun was kind of strange. There were several high school students who were coming home after school, and somebody called in and said they were gang members. And he said to me, "They're not gang members, just kids fooling around. It just happens a lot." And there were about a dozen kids in his park, and he drove up over the curb, over the sidewalk, up the grass into the park, into the group of kids, stopped, leaned his head out the window and said, "How do you like my rims?" And that was his idea of having fun on the job. I thought that this is the cop who did this. Yeah. I thought that was really a message to these kids that, you know, we're the boss. We don't play by rules. You have to play by rules. We don't. We're in charge, and we're going to lay this on you the rest of your lives. I really felt that was a very bad message to get. But that's an aside. Anyway, we came back to the high school, and we saw another cop who said that the person who had made the sexual assault charge, he says, "She's on more medications than you can name. She recanted her story. The assault didn't happen." So the guy I had been riding with, who was CIT trained, came out of there looking really wiped out. And we all went back to the station. That was the end of my day. But I really felt that these remarks about people being on medication, being likely to be in police situations, more likely than other people, leads to profiling of mentally ill people. Mentally ill people are people who commit crimes, and that's what the profiling to me seems to be. And they have the right to ask you if you're on medication, and if you are on medication, you have to tell them that. And then they have all a set of assumptions they're working with about what kind of person you are because you're taking psychiatric medication. So I emailed Officer Sancier about that, and he said that most crimes committed by mentally ill people are misdemeanors, and that there are courts where they go that direct them into treatment rather than jail for misdemeanor arrest, and that could be a reform. This Officer Sancier, has a PhD in psychology and has been through a therapy as part of that. Had a little more insight than the cops on the beat, but the cops on the beat that I saw were definitely profiling. Okay, I'll try and wrap this up by talking about what I learned about the main jail in San Jose. I talked to two very good sources about what was going on in the jail. One was a nurse named Nancy Rutherford, who I ran into after a Human Rights Commission meeting in San Jose. Looking for the meeting in the county building. She agreed to talk with me about her 2 months spent in the main jail working as a psychiatric nurse, basically. She was in the jail for only 2 months because she quit, because she was under pressure because she was not being callous enough to the prisoners. She gave out medication. That was her job. And she said it took her whole shift to give out the pills. So I got interested in finding out how many people in the jail were on medication. And I called the jail's spokesperson to the press. He referred me to the head of treatment, and she said I needed to present my questions in advance and couldn't ask her questions in person or on the phone. So I wrote down some questions, and she didn't answer half of them, saying she wasn't the person to answer them. And the other she answered very curtly with no detail. But the one thing I did learn from her was that on the average day in 2004, there were 634 inmates on medication in the main jail. The jail population, I found out from the press officer at the jail last year, was approximately 1,400. So if you do the math on that, it turns out that 45% of the population treated in the main jail in 2004 was on medication for mental illness. Now, whether they were all mentally ill, I'm not exactly sure. I'll read you a quote from what Nancy Rutherford told me. She said, there were so many inmates that you couldn't look at all their diagnoses. You're just giving these drugs to take, you're just giving them these drugs. My take on it is that they're chemically controlling a lot of people. The drugs have a lot of side effects. They have to be monitored very well, and I question if they're being monitored properly. So probably a lot of these medications are being taken by people because they make them a little more compliant. They probably don't mind taking them because they kind of feel good. And you have a situation where an absurd number of inmates are on psychiatric medication on a daily basis. Nancy Rutherford was criticized for taking too much time with inmates and for voicing concern over physical abuse of inmates. And with all the criticism headed her way, she saw the writing on the wall and she quit. Now she works in a psychiatric ward at the VA hospital. But that was a very interesting interview. And then after I published that on the website, I got a call from a woman named Ketsa at the Barrio Defense Committee who suggested I interview a man named Martin Rodriguez who had been tortured in the main jail. And I did that in Spanish. Once in person and then a follow-up interview on the phone. And he had a very interesting story. He was arrested on July 10, 2004 because his 12-year-old son was involved in gang activity. And he got a call that the son was going to be at a house where there was going to be a gang fight coming up. And he wanted to go pull his son out. So he went there, and a few minutes after he got there, I guess he had a beer or something. He had been having some beers. The police rolled up, and when that happened, all the kids disappeared in every direction. And he said that probably because they were carrying drugs on them, as they usually did. And they basically left him and his son, the only people left in the house. So the cops arrested him for possession of methamphetamine, being under the influence, and giving it to his son. And they, all of which were apparently false charges. And they brought him into booking. And booking is a high stress point where a lot of people are abused. And when the cops found out that he was in for providing his son with drugs, they used that as an excuse to basically beat the hell out of him, which they did. And they also, a very large officer, when he was at one point tied to a chair, forced his head down into his chest and put all his 300 pounds of weight into it, which he said was extremely painful. Then they put him in a cell and gave him painkillers for the injuries he had sustained while being beaten in booking. And when the painkillers wore off a few days later, he became psychotic. He told me he began to believe he was Cuauhtémoc and began to believe he was Montezuma, famous Aztec kings, and he believed he was David from the Bible. He really lost a sense of what was going on with himself. And at that point, he started refusing to eat and wasn't sleeping and was talking all the time incessantly. So they took him to the 8th floor, which is where the medical unit is, which is where they take people on for psychiatric treatment. And he was in there for a while, still refusing to eat, refusing medication, not sleeping. And they must have decided to subdue him. The head of treatment told me, you know, we don't subdue prisoners. But I find it very hard to believe. Not only from his story, but also from other stories I've heard of people who've been in mental hospitals. One of the things they do is subdue them in a hospital, not even a prison hospital. They always do that. They tie you to a chair, tie you to a table. That's part of their repertoire. At any rate, he said six of them came, and they beat him with their sticks. They ripped his clothes off so violently, he thought he was going to be raped. And they dragged him over and put him on a table where they lashed down his wrists and ankles. And then they tortured him there. They had shields, and they were pressing the shields against his head. He felt that he had to press back with his head, or his neck would snap. And he was all this time strapped down, totally helpless. He was also sexually abused while helpless. It sounds like a scene out of Abu Ghraib, the Iraqi prison guard. I've heard that those Iraqi guards learn their chops from guards in prisons in the United States, and I'm not surprised to see this happen in San Jose. Martine said, and I quote, "They break your body and your soul. They are very cruel there. They have no heart. And psychologically, I will never be entirely well." He went on to have public defenders. He's basically indigent. And he had public defenders who, one of them told him that his desire to plead innocent of the charges against him was an example of his being a danger to himself and part of the psychiatric condition, which I found to be just ridiculous. So he's been through many public defenders, I think like nine, and he's hoping for a good legal representation and hoping for a good psychological evaluation, and his court case is still pending, although they dropped the charge of him supplying his son with methamphetamine because his son tested negative for methamphetamine. But that's the extent of my investigation. For the future, I think that the Coalition for Justice and Accountability will continue to do good work. They're working with the County Human Relations Commission, which deals with human rights issues in the county, and they're looking into mental health issues later this year. There's a new independent police auditor. She came from Berkeley, actually. She was handpicked by the chief of police, so expectations aren't really high, but it's possible that she investigates these shootings if something will come up. There's the CIT training, which may be expanded, and there's Prop 63, which is giving funds for mental health programs, and may turn out to be helpful if the funds go to places where they can really help the clients. As far as the progress of how far the cops have to go, I was told by an ex-San Jose cop that 20, 30 years ago when they had a man beating his wife or family, they would take him out of his house, walk him around the block a few times, pull him off, and put him back in the home and leave. And that's changed a lot. Now they have zero tolerance. If you hit somebody in your family, you're arrested, you go to jail. But that took a lot. That took a lot of doing to make that change. And I think it's going to take even more doing to change things so that the police know how to deal with mental illness cases and effectively de-escalate them instead of escalating them every time. Also, civil litigation is possibly useful. The Caltrans case comes up in September. In June, the family of a man who was killed by police, who was diagnosed schizophrenic, he was yelling at people in the McDonald's, and 20 minutes later he was suffocated by the police. They got $1 million judgment from a jury, even after there were no criminal charges against the cops. So it's possible that the police department will feel pressure from those kind of judgments, and that might lead them to do something. I think the most promising thing would be community policing. Allowing people in the community to police their own communities nonviolently, that's a whole area that can be looked into. And I think that if you involve people who know the individuals who get involved in police situations, and rather than chasing them away, involve them in helping, that can make a big difference as far as this kind of thing is concerned.
Excuse me, are you going to talk about mental health in prison?
I just learned about the jail, and I didn't look into prison situations. I know that was the topic of today's meeting, and I said it in the advertising, but I didn't actually look at San Quentin or any other prison situations, just at the San Jose jail situation.
I couldn't wait. Did you talk about the jail?
Yeah, I did.
I just want to raise one thing before we go on. I want to make sure that people maybe think about this as we're going on. While certainly the examples you gave are very, very serious, I think that there won't be any changes unless we all think about what are the assumptions that we're all using. Because if they're saying that people get post-training and they're going to get training on how to handle mentally ill people, we need to ask who's doing the training. Because right now, all these things are going with the assumption, and then people are right, people who take medication are out of control. That may be stigmatizing, but that is the reason for the medication. And the people say people need to take this medication because people have a brain disorder. If we keep accepting that there's something wrong with the brain and accept that these, quote, medications are the remedy, rather than looking at it the same way, maybe we might want to say people are right. If the police have to come in contact with people who are on medications all the time, or they just go off them, maybe instead of just accepting that, we might want to think, that's what we've been, maybe there's a reason that maybe these medications don't work, maybe they're destructive, maybe they're causing the problems they're supposed to remedy. I just would like us to think about it in a different way, because the way we've been thinking about it, this is so stigmatizing. Maybe let's look at these instances. Would it be okay to have treated this woman or these three individuals the same way, whether or not they were diagnosed mentally ill? Okay, I'll get off the soapbox. I just want to make sure that we start. Otherwise, I'm not going to be happy with some of these remedies that may be coming up. Who's doing the training? Are they training us in the same old, under the guise of beneficence and isn't it better? Okay, I promise.
I'm on the CalCAT committee, and Peter has participated as a media person. He doesn't represent the entire complexity of the CalCAT committee. And you're going to hear from my discussion, we have made a major agenda on the directions that you have said, and me and Jose and other people have become an integral part of this committee. We're very proud of. We've become an integral part of this committee, and the issues you raise have been taken seriously, and a part of the process. And while Peter is representing how it looks like in this media world, you're right, and you're working at it, and come to the meeting.
I just want to make sure people at least think about that. I don't have the answers.
I just wanted to put in a little footnote. I don't know what they gave him for painkillers. And my experience isn't that the painkillers alone would make him psychotic. Or he felt that way. But I don't want, even if they do something wrong, which they definitely shouldn't, and that is awful. But no one should be suffering in pain without some pain medication, because there's a lot of that going on in prisons, and people are really suffering dramatically without.
Yeah, he needed pain medication. He was in pain because he had been beaten up.
Oh, of course.
He needed the pain medication.
Step one was
just
wrong.
I might have overstated the importance of the medication in that case, because what I was really thinking was that the pressure of a good father being called somebody who was trying some drugs and then being beaten for it, the psychological pressure of that, and then being in a cell, and then being abused every day by the guards like they were abusive. All of that, and painkillers, I mean, Vicodin or something can give you a sort of a false sense of well-being. I can see that when it might have been the catalyst that went away at one point. That might have been the catalyst. But the fact that he became psychotic while he was in jail was a result of the conditions under which he was being kept there and why.
Thank you.